He kept her in a cupboard, then under a stove in the kitchen, and finally in the false-bottomed trunk. For a while, he rather cockily propped her postcard on the mantelpiece, and in the letter to Gary, he signs himself Leonardo Vincenzo. But fairly soon, he seems to have found her hard to look at, impossible to live with. There is evidence of repeated attempts to sell her. The object Perugia stole is painted on a rectangle of poplar wood, only 77 centimetres high.
"Not even the size of the new TV screens,"
was the notorious objection of Americans seeing her in the 50s. I find that reaction strange, having the opposite feeling, that the actual painting is much bigger than I ever expect. Perhaps that's because the Mona Lisa is scaled in one's mind to the size of an infinite number of postcards and reproductions. In reality, set in concrete, behind triple layers of bulletproof glass, she seems as large as any incarcerated offender. How the Mona Lisa struck people in 1911, we shall never know. Nowadays, her photograph, her fame, precedes her, so that every sighting is inflected. Does she match up? Does she look different? How does she compare with our expectations? Her beauty, for instance. Mona Lisa, the person, not the painting, was the epitome of beauty for so many 19th century writers and 20th century singers. Yet to me, she is anything but, with her chipmunk cheeks, her close-set eyes and depilated face. She's famous even in parts, the hunched silhouette, the complacently folded hands, and she's quite possibly the only painting everyone can immediately summon to mind without even closing their eyes. But I find it hard to believe that her pole place in cultural life really has to do with intrinsic beauty, either hers or that of the painting. But we'll come to that. The photographs of the crime scene a century ago show not a dramatically empty glass case, as one would nowadays see, or even a large expanse of bare wall, but a narrow gap between the Titians and Correggios, something more like a missing tooth. It's well known that hundreds and eventually thousands of people came to view this spot, this gap, this rumoured blank. Some were apparently incredulous that the painting really had been stolen and sought the ocular proof. Many more people, it is often pointed out, than used to visit when the painting was there. But there was something to see, not quite a blank. Four iron hooks and a dusty outline. The ghostly trace of the painting. The smile was missing, or was it hanging in the air like the proverbial Cheshire cat? Some claim to have felt it continuing to resonate like a visitation. And it is, after all, the Mona Lisa's crowning glory, this artful, vanishing act. A smile is such a tricky thing to depict. It nearly always stiffens and dies on the canvas. The Mona Lisa's is only enigmatic because of Leonardo's sfumato technique, that smoky, smudgy blur where you can't see how the smile ends at each corner, so that it simply tails away, unresolved, literally open-ended. Sfumato is not the only thing that makes her smile mysterious, of course. There are many contributory factors, but high on the list is the total absence of any visible context or event that could help to explain the smile. Vasari reduced it all to a sideshow. Leonardo had laid on musicians and jesters to keep his sitter from ennui. Some people think that she's remembering lost love. Quite recently, the psychoanalyst Darian Lido wondered why nobody had suggested what he thought a much more obvious cause, that Leonardo had exposed himself to the sitter. But if the Mona Lisa were handed a baby, her smile would become beatific and make her look perhaps even more like a secular Madonna. With a couple of jesters on site, she might come across as polite, if slightly disapproving. The art historian Edgar Vind once slotted her into two different scenes to illustrate this point, and was able to show that the same expression could look like grief at the crucifixion, or tipsy mirth in the context of a bacchanalian revel. But in any event, the smile of the Mona Lisa is completely disengaged, neither on nor off, and definitely not interested in seeking you out in particular, or beaming a direct message to the present. No connection is being made, no invitation is on its way. The woman is completely self-contained, locked in her own time and place, and in the subaqueous murk of the painting. Smiles in art inevitably raise the question of their own existence. What brought them into being in the first place? Mona Lisa smiles, but why? Nobody's talking, no jokes are being cracked, there are no letters to read, no dinners to eat, no babies to dandle. Where is the probable cause? And all of the many interpretations of her smile, lonely, tragic, self-conscious, uncomfortable, superior, depend upon that lack of explanation. But what they also depend upon, and did in 1911, is a much greater absence. The Mona Lisa's missing eyebrows. She has such a curious look, denuded, or as if chemotherapy had worked its bittersweet way, depriving her of not just eyebrows, in fact, but eyelashes too. Though the eyebrows are truly crucial, for they give definition not just to the eyes, but to the whole face. The Mona Lisa's eyebrows were there during Leonardo's lifetime. A visitor to his house in France, where the artist went to work for the French king Francois I in his final years, mentions them. Vasari, the great Renaissance art historian, also gives a description of the painting.
The eyes were sparkling and moist, as they always are in real life. Around them were reddish specks and hairs that could only be depicted with immense subtlety. The brows could not be more natural. The hair grows thickly in one place and lightly in another, following the pores of the skin.
Recently, a Parisian engineer dedicated 3,000 hours to examining Leonardo's painting using ultra-detailed digital scans. Pascal Cotte concluded that the 240-megapixel images show clear traces of a left eyebrow, long obscured from our eyes by the clumsy efforts of restorers. It's only a hint, but a hint is precisely what our eyebrows give, a clue, or more, to the meaning of our expressions. So the Mona Lisa has been deprived of the very features that might have given her smile its conclusive definition. With eyebrows, she would still look out from the deep, slow glazes of Leonardo's paint, but without the absolute enigma. Francois I is the reason that any of us can see this portrait. Leonardo began painting the Mona Lisa in Florence around 1503 and took it with him when he left for France 13 years later. After his death in 1519, the painting passed through several hands until Francois managed to buy it for today's equivalent of around £9 million. When the aristocracy fell during the French Revolution, the painting became part of the public collection of the Louvre. A small snag with Perugia's patriotic defence during the trial, that his motive for stealing the Mona Lisa was not money, but to return her to the motherland, avenging Napoleon's rapacious plundering of artworks from Italy, was that the Mona Lisa was never stolen from the Italians in the first place. The Italian press may have been touched by his claim, but not the jury at his trial. Perugia was sentenced to 12 months in 1914. Eventually, he returned to France and opened a paint shop in Haute-Savoie. The Mona Lisa was given a triumphal tour of Italy before she too went back to France. For the record, Perugia's testimony also includes an admission that the Mona Lisa was not his first choice for theft. He originally had his eyes on Mantegna's Mars and Venus, also Italian, but it's slightly closer to television size. and might not have fitted underneath his smock. What was the true effect of this most famous of all art thefts? For one thing, immediate and intense repetition. It's the cinematic cliché of rolling presses, of tomorrow's newsprint rushing around the cylinders, carrying images of the Mona Lisa around Europe, to America, across the Far East, to Australia. Her face becoming a global edition, and with each face, a repetition of all the anecdotes about her smile, her supernatural powers, and so on. Warhol's 15 minutes of fame is not enough if you want to keep in the public eye for good. Every time a new lead came up, or a new clairvoyant claimed to know where she was, the Mona Lisa's lukewarm smile appeared in the press again. And when she finally came back, people came to see that she was safe, to see if she'd changed, to see if she looked like the reproductions, to see what all the fuss was about. Which is pretty much what happens to this very day. As early as the 1930s, French politicians were proposing that the Mona Lisa have her own separate gallery because all the Cook's tours go to see it. When she was sent to America in 1963, escorted by André Malraux, de Gaulle's Minister for Cultural Affairs, and the source of that great aperçu, "Museums do not simply exhibit masterpieces, they create them," she was treated like the celebrity she had already become in France. People came not to look at the painting, Robert Hughes has said, but to say that they'd seen it. From that moment, Hughes traces the pernicious rise of the hyperinflated art market. But its effect on museum culture has been devastating too. Visitors have to trek to her gallery at the Louvre. What's the trip without that stop? And see if she's still casting her spell. Partly that's in the nature of smiling pictures. A smile in a painting is an event, ongoing, still taking place in time. The picture seems not to have stopped. But partly, too, this is because she has both a half-life in Leonardo's portrait, beneath its amber varnish, and a whole life as a reported phenomenon. Is she as mysterious as everybody says? Better find out. I hate the way that the Louvre is navigated by three signposts. This way to the Venus de Milo, the Mona Lisa, the Victory of Samothrace. The Louvre is reduced to celebrity spotting, its entire contents organised around the orienteering points of its most famous works, especially the Mona Lisa. You do not go to the Prado and find yourself routed via Velázquez's Las Meninas. Thank God, otherwise you'd never be able to see that greatest of all paintings behind the milling scrum of backs. But at the Louvre, there's I.M. Pei's glass pyramid to get you in and Leonardo's Mona Lisa to get you done and out. No doubt the curators think the signposts expedient. In a merry New Yorker cartoon dating back to the 50s, an American couple rush into the Louvre and ask the guard, "Which way to the Mona Lisa? We're double parked." The signs make things so much easier today, and so much quicker. If you believe in slow looking, and going to museums to see just one work at a time, really getting deeply acquainted, then the Mona Lisa is the last work on earth that you will ever experience in this way. You queue to see her behind a winding cordon like those at airport security. You get your brief moment, and you're instantly sent on your way. And though I cannot blame Perugia entirely for this disaster, nor the fact that almost nobody looks at Veronese's stupendous wedding at Cana in the same gallery, as vast as it is ignored, the theft of the Mona Lisa a century ago contributed exponentially to the painting's fame across the world, to this idea of a woman with a mysterious past, still here haunting the present, a spectacle in a glass case. When the Mona Lisa travelled to Japan in 1974, the harvesting speed of the millions who saw her was recorded at under 30 seconds. when the Louvre conducted a survey a few years ago, they found that people looked at the Mona Lisa for an average of 15 seconds. Imagine what they spend on the rest of the paintings. The more people come to look at the Mona Lisa, the less people actually ever see it.
The Picture Vanishes was presented by Laura Cumming, with Carl Prokop as the voice of Walter Pater and Vasari. And the producer was Duncan Minchell. Well, you can hear the prommers in the arena chanting, as they so often do beneath me. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. Mozart's Requiem, which we're going to hear now in the second half of tonight's prom, I would say is about as enigmatic as Mona Lisa's smile. It has a great story to it, mysterious and compelling, which people love to tell and hear. But it can make us forget the other side to this piece, that it's a living, breathing work of music that people love to hear and to sing in choral societies across the country. And just this afternoon, the BBC Proms held a Come and Sing event across the road from the Albert Hall in the Royal College of Music. The vocal expert Mary King led 200 amateurs through some of the choruses in the Mozart Requiem. So I've just come into the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music to catch the very, very end of, I'd say, about 200 people singing the Lacrimosa from the Mozart Requiem. Amazing sound. Tell me a bit about what singing you've done before and how you came to this event.
Well, I've sung previously in school choirs and ad hoc choirs at college. So we decided to come along purely because it was just such a thrill to sing the Mozart Requiem.
Have you ever sung it before?
No, never. So we've thoroughly enjoyed it. An excellent selection of excerpts from it as well.
Great. And do you sing in choirs?
Not at all, no. My wife encouraged me to come along with her just to accompany her more than anything. It's been fantastic fun. Really, really enjoyed it. It's super.
Has it inspired you to join a choir?
I'm sure my wife will try and encourage me to join a choir now.
Singing is such a fantastic way of joining other people and sharing something that... Everyone can really do if encouraged and instructed in the right way. And I feel today the direction that we had from Mary King was absolutely fantastic.
And are you looking forward to the concert tonight?
Very much so, yeah, very much so. I don't think we'll be singing along though. I think that would be just a bit too much.
Tell you, they'd get some pretty dirty looks if they did sing along, but it's lovely to think that 200 people who were there this afternoon at the Royal College of Music are here in the Albert Hall right now. Next Sunday's Come and Sing event, incidentally, is on Mendelssohn's Elijah, 2 o'clock in the afternoon if you're coming along to the prom. Well, tonight's conductor, Stephen Layton, works with all manner of singing groups, choirs big and small, amateur and professional, like tonight's group Polyphony. So how's he approaching the much-loved Mozart Requiem tonight?
I think that once one is confronted by certain forces that you know are going to perform it, then the approach to it comes from that. Now this evening, sure, we're going to be performing it in one of the largest buildings in the world, but actually with smaller forces than might be imagined from such a building. Forces that I know well, and forces that I'm used to allowing the music, if you like, to be extremely text-led. Text-driven.
So consonants must be extremely important to get the sound across in a hall as large as the
Clearly they are, because, you know, if you're going to try to reach out to 6,000 people, it's not necessarily volume that really counts. It's actually the projection. And, of course, in the old performing trick, once an audience is confronted by the eyes of performers and musicians, they believe they're receiving more information than they may well be. You know, the whole thing is amplified by that look.
Conductor Stephen Layton, his choir Polyphony are on stage already now with the City of London Symphonia, who's just tuned up. And we're going to hear Mozart's Requiem, which earlier on this year was voted the nation's favourite Mozart by you, Radio 3 listeners. piece which, amazingly, was first heard at the Proms in 1961. That feels remarkably late. Well, making their way on stage now are our four soloists, the soprano Emma Bell, the mezzo Renato Popovic, the tenor Ian Bostridge, whom we heard in the first half of the Prom as well, and Hank Naven, the bass, who's replacing James Rutherford at short notice. With them, Stephen Layton to conduct Polyphony and the City of London Symphonia in the Requiem in D minor by Mozart.
Spartans sonum. Tumanirum Spartans sonum per sepulcra region caucet omnes ante tronum, caucet omnes ante tronum.
Vals dubivit et natura, cum resulget creatura, juliganti res monsura.
Thank you.
Mozart's Requiem in D minor, among the last notes that Mozart wrote before he died so young, completed by his pupil Zusmeier, and performed live here tonight in the year 2011 at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall. By four soloists, Emma Bell, Renata Popovic, Ian Bostridge and Henk Naven, the choir Polyphony and the City of London Symphonia, conducted by their artistic director, Stephen Layton. Tonight's prom celebrates the 40th anniversary of the City of London Symphonia, founded in 1971 by Richard Hickox and dedicated to his memory, the conductor who died 3 years ago. Extraordinary work, the Mozart Requiem. Really came across in the Albert Hall tonight. As Stephen Layton was saying before we heard that performance, he'd been rehearsing with Polyphony, his choir, to really get the consonants and the words across in this vast space. And it's worth mentioning that it's a slightly peculiar orchestral lineup, the Mozart Requiem. Oh, that cheer is for Polyphony. Stephen Layton bringing his choir to their feet. And the orchestra too. Surprisingly, no flutes or oboes or clarinets in Mozart's scoring at all. Two basset horns, two bassoons, three trombones and two trumpets joining the strings and chamber organ. There are four soloists coming on stage now. And behind them, the leader of the City of London Symphony tonight, violinist Laura Samuel. That's not the last of Mozart we're going to be hearing at proms, I should say. His final piano concerto, the concerto number 27, you can hear next Saturday evening, that's the 27th of August. The pianist Maria Joao Pires plays that with David Zinman and the Zurich Tornhalle Orchestra. And there's more choral music next Sunday. It's a choral Sunday's theme going throughout the proms this year. It's Mendelssohn's Elijah at 7 o'clock next Sunday. Paul McCreesh directs the Gabrielli Consort. There's a line by the poet Christopher Reed which appears in No Man's Land, the piece by Colin Matthews, which we heard the world premiere of earlier on this evening, which I think really sums up the experience of being at the proms. It says, the entire company stops to listen, as if listening too were a form of music, and our assembled silence as big as an orchestra. The assembled silence tonight certainly was as big as a very large orchestra indeed, as is the applause here at the Royal Albert Hall. More music from the proms tomorrow night comes from the BBC Symphony Orchestra and their chief conductor Jerzy Bieloflavek. Another world premiere, a BBC commission this time, a new piano concerto from Kevin Volans, which will be played by Barry Douglas with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. That's tomorrow night's prom. And of course, live like every of the BBC proms here on BBC Radio 3. So with Stephen Layton bringing everyone on stage to their feet to more cheers here at the Albert Hall, it's time for me to bid you good night and pass you on to Jill Anderson in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Sarah. That was Sarah Moore-Peach at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Tuesday afternoon at 2:30 here on Radio 3. And it's also available for the next 7 days on the online on the BBC iPlayer. Well, coming up in a few minutes' time, our Sunday feature, which is called Do Not Expect Applause, The Life and Poetry of W.S. Graham. It's a celebration of 20th century poet W.S. Graham, who influenced the work of Harold Pinter. He was born in Greenock in 1918 and he lived most of his adult life in Cornwall. So that's the Sunday feature, and it's followed at 10:15 by Words and Music, The Eternal City, and it's an edition devoted to everyday life in ancient Rome, featuring texts by Pliny, Juvenal, Dickens and Mark Twain, read by Sean Phillips and Peter Marinka, with music by Wagner, Berlioz, Britten and Puccini. And there's jazz at 11:30 in Jazz Lineup. Daniel Perez discusses his album Providencia, and Julian Joseph previews the forthcoming King's Place Jazz Festival in London. So that's what we have in store for you here on BBC Radio 3 for the rest of the evening. So to take us up to the Sunday feature, let's hear Maria João Pires playing more Mozart. This is the Fantasy in D minor, K397.
Thank you.
Mozart's Fantasy in D minor, K397, was played by Maria João Pires. And you can hear her playing Mozart's Piano Concerto, number 27 in B flat, in the Prom on the 27th of August. And just a correction to something that was said earlier this evening, the conductor of tomorrow's Prom will now be Thomas Dausgaard. That's a programme of Wagner, the Master Singer's Overture, Liszt, Kevin Volland and Brahms Symphony No. 1. That's the Prom. It starts at 7:30 tomorrow. Well, also tomorrow at 1 o'clock, our Prom's chamber music concert, given by the internationally renowned flautist Emmanuel Paud. He's a featured artist at this year's Proms and he brings a chamber programme to Cadogan Hall with his regular pianist Eric Lesage. Three contrasting works share the same genesis, all being composed in the early 1940s under the shadow of World War II, but all have a sunny nature. Martinu's sonata was completed in America after he fled his native Czechoslovakia. Prokofiev's magnificent sonata was written in Moscow and it's one of his classic works, both brilliantly virtuosic and warmly lyrical. Dutilleux's early sonatine follows in the footsteps of his predecessor, Debussy. And you can hear those works played by Emmanuel Paul tomorrow in the Proms Chamber Music Concert just after the 1 o'clock news.
Good evening, listeners.
It was designed to introduce ordinary listeners to serious music.
A member of my family always sings it thus. Hello, you silly fellow, would you like to hear a fugue?
And radio was at its forefront.
Now you've got to sing all that straight through with me as if you've known it all your lives.
But how did music appreciation fall out of favour? And could it make a comeback?
Let me show you what he might have done.
The essay this week on BBC Radio 3 explores eight decades of a prominent British movement with its origins, ambitions and idiosyncrasies attached. The essay on BBC Radio 3 starts tomorrow night at 10:45.
Oh, they don't make them like that anymore. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 9:30. And in this week's Sunday feature, the poet Paul Henry shares his passion for one of our great 20th century poets. W.S. Graham was a contemporary of Dylan Thomas, influenced the work of Harold Pinter, and was hailed as a genius by his editor, T.S. Eliot. This is Do Not Expect Applause.
Intimate, challenging, sometimes loving, sceptical, cheeky, lyrical, spikily attractive.
Graham is the poet I suppose I've been closest to over the years. There are times when I get so deep into his poetry that I almost can't see him as just another poet. He's a poet that's been intimately bound up with my life. But if you had to choose a poet to be intimately bound up with your life, I think you couldn't make a better choice than Graham. And it's partly because I'm a poet myself, and Graham is the poet's poet. He's the poet who has more to say about what it means to be a poet than any other poet I can think of.
Some book titles leap out from their spines. I first picked up Implements in Their Places, the Scottish poet W.S. Graham's last collection of poems, in a charity shop in Cardiff about 10 years ago. I later became familiar with the author's earlier work through his long, sonorous 1950s poem, The Night Fishing, for which Graham, the subject of this programme, is perhaps still best known. It's a thunderous piece which builds and rebuilds the architecture of the sea.
We drive down into the roar of the great doorways, each time almost to overstay, but start up into again the yelling gale and hailing shot of the spray.
It's that Cornish sea spray I'm enjoying now as I stand at Gurnet's Head, next to the cottage where W.S. Graham lived for a time, here in Cornwall. But The Night Fishing is a poem very much of its time, not that dissimilar in tone and rapture from the poetry of Graham's friend and contemporary, Dylan Thomas, who W.S. Graham was to outlive by 33 years. Implements in Their Places, on the other hand, was a different kettle of words. The authority and physicality of that title suggested someone who had made both the craft and mystery of language their concern.
It is best I sit here, where I am to speak on the other side of language. You, of course, in your own time and incident, I speak in the small hours, will listen from your side. I am very pleased we have sought us out.
I'm Paul Henry, and in this programme I want to learn more about fellow poet Graham's life, the spirit behind the lines, and, of course, the work itself, what it was that led T.S. Eliot and Harold Pinter to acknowledge his genius. I want to understand better what I love about his last two 1970s collections, Malcolm Mooney's Land and Implements in Their Places, where his obsession with the obstacle of language, as he put it, leads to an almost supernatural intimacy with his readers.
I think I hear you hearing me. I think I see you seeing me. I suppose I am really only about 2 feet away. You must excuse me. Have I spoken to you before? I seem to know your face from someone else I was.
In these final collections, upon which, since his death in 1986, Graham's growing reputation is largely built, the poet co-opts the reader into the poem, so that you have this trinity of poem, poet and reader, all crucial to the same event. It's as if he waves at you from behind the lines while you read.
Tap, tap. Are you reading that tap, tap I send out to you along my element? To answer, please tap, tap quickly along the nearest metal. When you hear from me again, I will not know you.
Whenever the work of W.S. Graham is discussed by the few who've discovered him, you hear repeated the cliché, poet's poet. But it would seem this refrain is justified in Graham's case. Sometimes he feels like the biggest secret of 20th century literature. But he's not just my secret. I was curious to learn how other poets who discovered Graham interpreted the qualities of his work. I spoke first with poet Tiffany Atkinson, Robin Marsek, director of the Scottish Poetry Library, and then the poet and critic Professor Robert Crawford.
W.S. Graham's work is the only, or the best example I have ever read of a writer who seems to embody through his work the tension that I think most writers must feel in wanting to write between a tremendous desire to be expressive and to somehow create a world full of words, but also a similar awareness of the problems with that and the difficulties of language and the obstructions of language. And he manages to bring those two things together in a way which is completely unique and very funny, very witty, very surprising, and actually very beautiful. When, as an academic idea, I suppose that could sound very dry and dull, in Graham's hands it is anything but. And for me, that's the most valuable aspect of his work.
I think it's quite rare to find a poet who talks about language in the way he does, that's yet so personal and so questioning and yet so accessible. I like that. What is the language using me for? There is that sense that he's cast out there, adrift almost on the sea of language, and having to make his own way without many guides at all.
The poems are almost ship-built or clyde-built. The way they fit together is consciously articulated within the poem itself, that there are structures that are being erected, played with, manipulated.
To find out about Graham the Man, I'm going to visit the artist Michael Snow, who, alongside his late wife Margaret Snow, edited The Night Fisherman, the selected letters of W.S. Graham. Michael was a member of the St. Ives School of Painters, which so inspired Graham when he lived in Cornwall, and was a close friend and drinking companion of the poet in the Gurnard's Head when he lived near Zena.
Hello,
Michael.
Hello, nice to see you.
Lovely to meet you. Beautiful part of the world. Thank you.
Thanks.
Michael's house was full of his own wonderful paintings and a treasure trove of W.S. Graham memorabilia. One photo of Graham which caught my eye saw the poet pinned against a dartboard in a pub bar,
in irreverent, sacrificial pose. I was beginning to wonder how wild a man was this contemporary and friend of Dylan Thomas.
He needed a drink to get him started, but it was really just to release the imagination. And also, he liked to have people to talk to. I mean, for the most part, Sidney was sensible, and but with a few drinks in him, like everybody else, he became less inhibited. And he certainly did a few wild things. I mean, he, I think on a couple of occasions, actually finished up in jail. His work was private, and he wanted to be completely alone in the middle of the night to be doing that. But in the pub, he'd talk to anybody. Nobody would escape.
And was he an extrovert at the bar or a ghost in the corner?
No, he definitely was never a ghost in the corner. One of the problems, as people sometimes found, was that he tended to want to dominate any conversation or any event that was taking place. I've known him, even at another poet's reading, interrupt him in the middle of it and explain that he wasn't doing it properly. I was so embarrassed, I didn't know where to put myself. And, of course, he had this strong sort of interest in drama, and he tended to create mini-dramas out of things in the pubs, ask people to take parts in a play. Or a good example of that was the occasion when he wanted to create a mini-drama at Gurnard's Head. He wanted to make an entrance in the pub as though coming in from a storm, and he persuaded the two or three people in the pub who were there quite quietly that they should be making noise of wind and generally sort of sound effects for a storm. He'd get them all going very well, he'd engage them, and they would be doing this, you know. But then, of course, he went out and he didn't come back. They were all sitting there doing this for some time before they realised it.
He'd gone home.
Yes.
And was he, outside of the obvious conversations on literature, was he a political animal?
In terms of politics, you could say he was an internationalist rather than a nationalist. He certainly wasn't a Scottish nationalist, because he regarded that as a very parochial literary scene. It was very clear during his life that he instinctively reacted against any received authority. But he didn't make public statements of a political nature because he also had a profound distrust of political parties of any sort. You don't get the sort of political statements that his friend Harold Pinter made, and I think Sidney's probably equally important on a deep level because they encouraged individuals to think more closely about the nature of their own existence and the way in which they behaved themselves as members of society, instead of simply joining a political party and waving a flag.
There is an aloneness about Graham, isn't there?
I think it's something which he almost specialised in externalising. He certainly felt his own isolation in the way that any creative artist feels isolated if they are being experimental. The aloneness of anyone being creative. There is also the aloneness which is necessary in order to do the work. And that, in Sidney's case, was also very clear. If he was in the pub, he was having games. If he was at home, he was writing. When he was working on some of the longer poems, like The Night Fishing, for example, there are many references to the fact that he used to take drugs to... people thought enjoy himself, but in fact his reason was that they kept him awake and that he could work sometimes for 24 hours at a stretch on a poem. It needed that sort of continuity and that sort of concentration to achieve what he actually wanted.
What was Nessie's role in helping him through the darker times?
Nessie was a very stable person. She was deeply appreciative of Sidney's work and deeply understanding of it too, and she had written poems herself, so she knew quite a lot of what the business was about. As an individual person, she'd supplied a great deal of labour, and she was the person who in the early days had certainly gone out to work on the farms or work in the hotels to supply them with a living of any sort. In a period where Sidney couldn't do that in the sense that he was demanding of himself a degree of concentration. Nessie's role really was to provide that sort of availability of communication, to be there as a person for Sidney when Sidney needed a person. So it was a sort of moral strength. And she needed a great deal of moral strength to cope with the circumstances in which she found herself.
Some of Graham's most beautiful lyrics are to Nessie Dunsmuir. Was she his only inspiration in life?
No, I'm sure not, in the sense that I think everything that happened to Sidney was something that had an effect on his poetry. Certainly his relationship with Nessie began at a very early age, and it survived all sorts of trials and tribulations, which included a whole series of other people with whom he had relationships. And many of these were creative relationships in the sense that they provided stimulus and raw material and instruction for Sidney. And one thinks, for example, of the Johann Joachim Quantz Five Lessons poems, which were directly inspired by a gift from the professional musician Ruth Hilton of the Quantz treatise on playing flute.
Do you think he realised how great a poet he was?
He liked to say to people that he felt that he was a great poet, but it was not a statement that was made with any seriousness. He was quite content to leave that to the judgment of others at a later date.
So what of the judgment of others, especially with regard to the early poems of W.S. Graham, the work he published between 1944 and 1955, which culminated in the collection The Night Fishing? I feel lucky that I found his later work first. For me, much of these earlier poems are a rehearsal of craft, sub-Joycean, sub-Dylan Thomas, victims of their own energy, as Andrew Motion has it. Here's writer and editor Professor Michael Schmidt, who published many of Graham's poems.
I think they're more victims of what he thought a poem should be. It's not so much an energy as a preconception of, you know, a poem should be, should work in this particular way. And so he, some of them are very beautiful, but they all have that kind of terrible stasis that I associate with Dylan Thomas, where you have a sense of energy, but, for example, the syntax is rigidly constructed stanza by stanza. So it is like a kind of language being held very tightly on a wheel, if you like. And it was getting that stifled, that stilled language into movement that was the miracle of The Night Fishing.
And how did Matthew Francis, poet and editor of Graham's collected poems, view this early work?
The early poems, he's very prolific. He wrote an enormous amount very quickly, and I think that's partly because they're very formulaic, and they're built around phrases that are designed to be as paradoxical and as impressive as possible, and he just kind of jams all these phrases together. I think the very early poems are not strong, but actually ideas and more interesting structures start to come in at a fairly early stage. I mean, I think by The White Threshold, he's writing some very powerful and interesting poems, quite moving poems too.
They're clotted, they're full of these kind of kennings and neologisms and nouns being qualified into the sense he wants to make of them. And they're cluttered and clotted, and the music's cluttered, you know, and it's all a bit of a train wreck.
We haul and hold and haul well the bright chirpers home. So drifted whitely all a blinding garment out of the grey water.
It's wonderful, of course, because it has this great verbal energy, but you can see where it's come from. It came out of the apocalypse stuff in the 40s. It came through a kind of English you know, sort of, and I mean English, sort of misreading of the Wallace Stevens Harmonium when it hit the beach very late in the 40s in the UK. It came through Thomas, who's a wonderful poet, but a terrible influence, as we know. It came through middle period Eliot. It came through just a whole bunch of bad examples, I think, unfortunately, you know, and it's just like, I really don't like it. I mean, I have colleagues here that think Night Fishing is a wonderful poem, and I can see what the appeal is.
Gently, the key bell strikes the held air. Strikes the held air like opening a door, so that all the dead brought to harmony speak out on silence.
But for me, it was just, you know, I just kind of stand that kind of clutter in the language. And of course, the late stuff is nothing like this at all. It's all gone.
That was award-winning poet Don Paterson. And here's fellow Scotsman and poet Robert Crawford.
I think his early poems can be victims of their own energy. They're also a bit like a submarine that's got snagged in the nets of Dylan Thomas and a kind of new apocalypticism that was a sort of fashionable way of writing rather over-the-top poetry round about World War II. And that's there in Graham. I think he manages to pilot his submarine ahead and burst out of those nets and get out into rather excitedly uncharted waters later on.
I'm fascinated and somewhat inspired by Graham's wilderness years between the collection The Night Fishing in 1955 and Malcolm Mooney's Land in 1970, the 15 years when Graham published nothing and appeared to slip off everybody's radar. Even his publisher forgot about him. This interval proved crucial to Graham's development and marked a massive transformation in style and technique. I've often wondered what happened to him creatively down in Cornwall to effect this amazing change.
Helen Vendler has this great sort of argument about how poets have to break their style in mid-career. You know, Yeats does it, Eliot does it, Auden does it. I think it probably is a good thing if you can manage to do it. Otherwise, the danger is you just go on repeating yourself. And people don't say, I think, that the later Graham repeats the earlier Graham. But I think they may exaggerate how different the two are. But however you take it, when he went out there into no man's land for 15 years, he broke his style. And he comes back with something that has a wonderfully honed clarity that just takes your breath away sometimes. And yet it's still a wee bit odd. And in that oddity, in that not fitting in, is the gift.
Language, constrictor of my soul, what are you snivelling at? Behave better. Take care. It's only through me you live. Take care. Don't make me mad.
His publishers thought he'd died. I think Nikos Stangos of Penguin Books, wanting to do one of those Penguin trilogies, including his work, wrote to them and they said, oh, no, he's unfortunately died. And Nikos had some manuscripts from him, so he wrote back and said, I think you may find that he isn't as dead as you imagined. So what happened? I think he divorced himself from the literature scene. He didn't really probably much like what happened with the movement. He probably found the group itself, you know, this notion of a poetry produced by a group of people, you know, in consultation, really anathema. So I think this is what happened. He was living alone in Cornwall in great poverty. He was working on his poems. He was drinking too much. He was talking to painters. And I think that's what he did. He just basically concentrated on... And he didn't write slowly. He was obviously volcanically productive, if you like, but throwing things away. There must be tons of material either at the bottom of the sea or somewhere.
Who knows what's good for your creative life and what isn't. You know, the most terrible things could be good for your work or not.
Poet and playwright Liz Lockhead.
I wouldn't assume that just because Graham slipped off the radar and didn't publish anything for 15 years, I've got no idea whether he was writing loads of stuff that he threw away or whether he was fed up with the whole thing. You know, maybe he just kept working away in a ever more deadly seam for himself, and he perhaps threw them all away and then had a moment from Damascus.
Indeed, perhaps in these wilderness years, Graham had learned to destroy more than he kept. In her foreword to Graham's posthumous collection, entitled Aimed at Nobody, the poet's wife, Nessie Dunsmuir, offers an answer. I remember once joining him, helping to crumple up and throw on the fire a great number of drafts of poems. When I said, "Are you sure about all these?" he replied, reassuringly,
"Oh, yes. I know what I'm doing."
Graham, when he talks about silence, I think he's partly talking about the silences of his own work. And there are times when you realise you've said all you can say, and then you have to stop and listen and see what other messages there are for you out, somewhere out there. I'm speaking rather mystically, but that's the way Graham himself speaks about it in his poetry.
Once he's shed this slough of Dylan Thomas et al., Graham's later post-1970 work is almost an orchestration of silence, an obsessive tapping on the wall of language which appears to be like no one else's. John Kinsella, talking about the later work, has said, "There is no voice anywhere remotely like Graham's. His is unique." I wondered if others could describe Graham's work to somebody unfamiliar with it.
Intimate, challenging, sometimes loving, sceptical, cheeky, lyrical, spikily attractive.
I would say that it's distinctively personal. It's confiding in many ways. He writes letters, for example, and you have that very informal voice. And I think that's a very encouraging voice. In a way, I would ask people to start off with the late work and work backwards. I think they would find a lot of ways in.
I think it's the voice that he picked up from living really alone. It's a haunted voice. It's a lonesome voice. And it's a voice which is, as it were, always talking about talking. It's the kind of voice that I think a lot of French theorists would find a gift for their theories, because it's basically about the disconnection between language and the things it names, and between the way in which language creates disconnection between people rather than bringing them together. It's very, very vocalic. It's very vowel-rich, whereas the early poetry is very, very consonantal. It's extremely vowel-rich and modulates the vowels in a very beautiful way, almost like a kind of a good libretto would do. But the diction is very, very simple. So if you read him and you read, say, Gertrude Stein at the same time, there are lots of things in common between them. And one thing is this economy of means. What can I do without? What can I do without? The other echoes that you hear are the occasional intertextual echoes. First of all, he echoes his early work, and he actually writes letters to himself in the past, to himself in the future, and this kind of the sense that language could somehow transcend time. But then there are echoes like in The Thermal Stare, he speaks of the Jasper Sea, which is a quote from a Methodist hymn. So there are all these other kinds of echoes that come up, whether he does it consciously or not. And he doesn't do it consciously. I think he does everything, I think, by an instinctive art. I don't believe he was a deliberate artist in the way that he would construct a poem. He would see, for example, in Quants, he would write one Quants poem and think, oh, that was good. And then four more would sort of hover around and land on the same in the same suite.
So Graham emerges from the publishing cold, his 15-year absence, with a mysterious Arctic landscape or wordscape of Malcolm Mooney's land, a perfect backdrop for his central question.
Well, the central question, I suppose, that people think of when they think of Graham is the one, what is the language using us for? Now, the problem is that's become almost a trendy academic question. It's the sort of thing that structuralist and even post-structuralist critics rather like. There's a danger. It's like a piece of classical music that's been used in an advert. There's a danger that that question, what is the language using us for, fits too neatly with academics' concerns now. But Graham wasn't asking it as an academic question. He wasn't, say, Chomsky or a linguist or a Roland Barthes or a structuralist or post-structuralist thinker. He was a poet. So the next line is, you know, what on earth does the next line mean? What is the language using us for? Said Malcolm Mooney, moving away slowly over the white language. So language becomes terrain, becomes landscape. The poem is at once wonderfully physical and yet intellectually challenging. Graham has this sense, not quite of the death of the author, but of the author as being moulded by language, possibly more than the author actually moulds language for himself or herself. And that's made him important, made him almost too easy to discuss in seminar rooms.
The thing that first struck me when I first read that very first poem, What is the Language Using Us For?, was that I have never read such an eloquent account of what I think probably most writers struggle with, which is a sort of tension between knowing the limitations of language, and that language is actually quite clunky, and you know, compared with music or visual art, perhaps, it's a quite a stubborn material.
Have I not been trying to use the obstacle of language well? It freezes round us all.
Well, I think he's doing two things. He wants language to move in time, but he also wants language to transcend time. So basically, he wants to be able to write to himself in the future and the past. When he's writing The Night Fishing, he's making the whole sea a metaphor for language, isn't he? It does this and that, but there are the constants in it. There are the constancies. And we sail out on it as writers, as people, just speaking. And, you know, we're in peril. It's a dangerous place to go. Language is very treacherous. That, I think, is what's so wonderful. And so there's the one hand wanting something stable. You know, Wordsworth's line, the stationary blasts of waterfalls. He wants the stationary and he wants the blast at the same time. So and this is what language can't quite give us. It can give us one or the other.
What's so strange and magnificent is that along with that, there's a very deep sense of homecoming. So it's not just that he's journeying away out into weird icescapes where there are crevasses in the language, and language is a crevasse.
Yesterday, I heard the telephone ringing deep down in a blue crevasse. I did not answer it and could hardly bear to pass.
It's also that he's coming home to specific places that he knew years and years before when he was a child, like Loch Tom, which is a wee loch in the hills up above Greenock. And he writes a wonderful poem about that.
The curlew's cry, travelling still, kills me fairly. In front of me, the grouse flurry and settle. Go back. Go back. Go back. Farewell, Loch Tom.
The curlew's cry kills me fairly. He knows he's near the end of his life. He's going to die soon. So he, like a lot of people who are nearing death, he's thinking about his childhood and his childhood landscape. So some of the poems are very exploratory and way, way far out there, and others are just absolute homecomings. So yes, he's going way, way out, but he's also returning.
The one thing that's certainly apart from the later stuff is the business of silence and the business of transmission.
And yet I say this silence here, for in it I might hear you. I say this silence, or, better, construct this space, so that somehow something may move across